You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, December 5th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Bhaskar Sunkara, the founder and publisher of Jacobin Magazine, on why politics is the answer to Trump, finding pressure points in the Trump age, and will also reflect on the legacy of Fred Hampton, who was assassinated by Chicago police on this day, I think about 40 years ago. Could be wrong on that anniversary date. I'll check it. Also, a victory. President Obama, the Army Corps of Engineers, has called for a new environmental audit on the final leg of the Dakota Pipeline, a major win for organizers, the Sioux Nation, and everyone there fighting this horrific abuse of human rights. Everything right about the world happening in North Dakota and everything wrong with in the world happening in North Dakota, but an important victory. The process not over yet. Donald J. Trump, our incoming minority president and tweeter and chief, he's causing a serious conflict potentially with China over a call to Taiwan. He also thinks that the Pakistani people are fantastic, doing a great job. And another person who, of course, will do a great job is the Reverend Dr. Ben Carson, who is now taking over HUD, Housing Urban Development. It's a new plan called Biblical Real Estate. Give people gold bars if they can afford a voucher for it, and then everyone will have houses. I read about it online. It's going to be great. Italy's prime minister fails in an effort for constitutional reforms, and he is on his way out in a victory for the populist center as well as the xenophobic far right and the left. And in Austria, neo-fascists finally suffer a defeat in 2016 as an independent former leader of that country's Green Party wins the presidency over a far-right contender. That and much, much more on today's Majority Report. So, just to get to this really quickly, this is an incredible victory. I don't think the process is over yet, but that being said, we know that one of the reasons that the company was so intense about completing the pipeline on that time schedule and why there's been so much brutality and horrific treatment of the Sioux and of protesters and the water protectors in general is because if it goes past the December date for construction, the pipeline needs to be renegotiated and the company basically loses money because energy prices have dropped. So this is significant. The Army Corps of Engineers will not grant a permit for the Dakota Access Pipeline to drill under the Missouri River in a major win for activists. I'm going to quote really briefly now from the article in The Guardian. The Army Corps of Engineers will not grant a permit for the Dakota Access Pipeline to drill under the Missouri River, the Army announced on Sunday, handing a major victory to the Sioux Rock Nation tribe after a 12-month campaign against the pipeline. Assistant Secretary for Civil Works Joe Ellen Darcy announced the decision on Sunday with the Army saying it was based on a need to explore alternative routes for the crossing. Now, let's just play this clip. Are we ready to play sound? I want to play the Amy Goodman sound. Amy Goodman. Amy Goodman, of course, the co-host of Democracy Now! And really a veteran and incredibly important journalist and activist. She was there. If you recall, they were actually going to press charges against her for reporting on the ground in North Dakota. And even as we sort of savor this victory and take the lesson that activism and pressure, power only concedes to pressure, is the sort of really important lesson from this. Let's not forget how brutal and how dangerous and how horrific the whole process has been. And this is Amy Goodman's perspective as a journalist, you know, not as a citizen, not as a member of the Sioux who lives there, and not as a sort of day in and day out water protector, just as a journalist doing genuine and important reporting there. Check out her perspective on this that she shares with Brian Stelter on CNN this past weekend.
Covered was chilling. Native Americans came up to a site that the Dakota Access Pipeline was excavating. The Native Americans didn't expect this. It was a long holiday weekend. And the pipeline guards unleashed dogs and pepper spray on the Native American. They call themselves protectors, not protesters.
Water protectors.
We showed the video of a dog with its mouth and nose dripping with blood. When this video, when we published it that night, it went viral. 14 million views on Facebook. Every network, including CNN, ran that video coverage. It wasn't, what, 5 days later, when we were back here in New York, that the North Dakota authorities issued an arrest warrant for me. A month later, I would return with the Democracy Now! Team to continue covering the standoff at Standing Rock. And because I landed in Bismarck, well, the prosecutor said what we had said all along. There weren't grounds to hold us, but then they tried to hit us with a new charge.
A riot charge,
which could land me in jail from a month to a year. But fortunately, after covering more of the standoff that weekend, a judge intervened and said no, though the prosecutor and the sheriff have said that they can still find another way to arrest me. But what's important here is not about me. That was a message to all journalists: do not come to North Dakota. And that's why it's so serious. But most importantly, it's what's happening there on the ground, the largest unification of Native Americans, over 200 tribes and First Nations from Latin America, the United States, and Canada have gathered, the largest such gathering in decades. Right now, this weekend, is the final standoff.
Hundreds of veterans, maybe thousands of veterans arriving there this weekend.
Native and non-Native veterans.
And Monday's a new deadline.
And of course, Wes Clark Jr., who I talked to a couple of weeks ago, was a major part of that effort to bring veterans there to protect the protectors. So incredibly important and deep lessons for all of us. And we'll just play this celebration of fireworks of the victory for just a second that it was played at the No Doppel camp. It's great.
Could have been done a while ago. I think probably should have made this determination maybe months ago.
Oh, definitely.
Better late than never.
And it's better late than never to start drinking 8 glasses of water a day. But who really cares? Water is boring. And that's why you should try Hint Water. Hint Water was started by Kara Golden. A few years ago, after having her fourth child, she was overweight, had terrible acne, and overall felt awful. She was drinking 10 diet sodas a day instead of water. Kelly Matt, what? Hint. Because drinking water is boring, but what other options are there? Juice is full of calories and no calorie drinks are garbage. I always like the copy for Hint because they say garbage like I do. That's why she started Hint Water. Hint Water is pure, infused with the taste of fresh fruit. With Hint, drinking water isn't boring. They have flavors to suit any palate: watermelon, peach, mango, grapefruit, and many more. No sugar, no chemicals, just great tasting, all natural, fruit flavored water. Both Health and Self magazine have named Hint Water the best flavored water, and they know how important drinking plenty of water is to your health. We got the package of Hint, and I've enjoyed it immensely around the office. Plus, you don't have to carry heavy cases on your back from the store. You can have it delivered right to your doorstep. And right now, get a single variety pack shipped directly to your door, including 3 bottles of Hint's 4 most popular flavors, pineapple, watermelon, crisp apple, and blackberry, normally for $24 for only $15 at Drink Hint. That's drinkhint.com/majority. drinkhint.com/majority. drinkhint/majority.
You don't know about me. I drink a lot of Hint.
You know about me.
I drink a lot of Hint.
Drink and a lot of Hint.
You try to hide the Hint that comes to the office, but
no,
guess
that
what?
That was him, actually.
But guess what?
That was a cedar
I
hide.
I found it. I took my own.
That was a cedar hide. That was very... Because I'm concerned about everybody's...
That's right. Blame
Sam. Of course
I
would. I'm concerned about everybody's health. All right. Are you hiring, but don't know where to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post all of your jobs on all the top job sites, and now you can. ZipRecruiter already has 9 million resumes that you can search through in their database. You can add multiple people to your account to make the most efficient for your team to find the best hire. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to up to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks, which is really important, like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. ZipRecruiter is a search engine for finding and posting jobs. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once. Watch quality candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling your emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, hire the right person fast. If you have any issues, ZipRecruiter is friendly and human. That's so important. Support staff is ready to help you. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been rated by over 1 million businesses. Has been used by over 1 million businesses, as featured in Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, New York Times, TechCrunch, and CBS. ZipRecruiter's website shows trending career fields, cities, and searches. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. One more time, that's for free. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And when you're on your way to your job interview, you probably are going to want to look slick. And that's why I want to tell you about Movement Watches. You've heard me talk about Movement Watches, and I'm sure you've already got yourself one. Now let's finish your holiday shopping and get a Movement Watch for someone on your list. This is just what Sam did for Nikki. She loves it. Movement Watches start at just $95. At the department store, you're normally looking at spending $400 to $500. Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. Classic design and quality construction and styled minimalism. Over 500,000 watches sold in over 160 countries. And now you can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movementwatches.com/majority. That's MVMTwatches.com/majority. This watch is a really clean design. And I know, again, Nikki loves it. I've actually been asking around for more people about Movement, and I've discovered more Movement users that I didn't even know were Movement users, and they also love it. Now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to movementwatches.com/majority. That's movementwatches.com/majority. Join the movement. We'll be right back with Bhaskar Sankara on the Majority Report.
Meek, Shell, and Harry, the Earth.
I give up everything.
That's what the Bible
just
says.
To make you happy. But we both know, this ain't how life goes. We can build our own world, but the streets keep calling me.
Walk like a giant, talk like a tyrant. Faith of a mustard seed destined for a triumph. David or Goliath, hate me or admire. Burn slow as I chase my desires. Embrace my empire. Bout your boy, eat fire. Like choirs when they sing, keep quiet. Will I get to heaven? Turn to Psalm 27. Lord knows when I see this monkey, I'ma be the devil. Beat him cause I'm clever. Beat him at whatever. You never was a G. Unit mean together. New York unified. Down south, blood at. When we got the shine, where the love at? Real, getting money, better log on. Kick the game dead now. Imagine when your dog gone. Imagine when it's all gone. When your phone off, it's only one to call on.
If I could leave this place,
if I died today,
smile on my face,
I could honestly
I'd
say,
I give up everything.
Thank
just
you, Lord.
To make you happy.
Thank
but
you, Lord.
I'm bigger than a title, bigger than a name. You could label me the biggest label in the game. Put food on the table, fed the whole city. Tell me who be the fool if the feds come get me. 30 years or better when you call a trendsetter. The world's so cold, hope you got a little sweater. Caught a little case, but he had a little cheddar. Played out the 15, poured his life in a letter. Very first line, he called Trick Daddy stupid. Say he got A's telling people that it's...
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks. That was Rick Ross, which I didn't know I would ever pull off playing on the show, but I did. Thank you, super producer Matt. Joining us now is Bhaskar Sunkara. He is the founder and publisher of the really indispensable Jacobin magazine. He's also the dopest Marxist from Trinidad since CLR James. Bhaskar, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going, man? I'm all right.
It's good to be talking with you. Let's start.
Yeah, you know, it's been a rough month. You know, I think we're all looking for a little bit of love and therapy. But,
yeah,
exactly. You know, we'll make it through this.
We'll make it through this. I remember when I think the last time we were talking was like a week before the campaign, and we were expecting the sort of drudgery and misery of sort of pseudo woke neoliberal Clintonism. And then instead we actually got like full on clown fascism. So,
right,
yeah,
exactly.
So here we are.
The only thing worse than woke neoliberalism is unwoke neoliberalism.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, oh, no. I actually really don't like people of color, by the way.
Right. He's telling it how it is. I don't know. How could you hate it?
Yeah, telling it like it is. That's it. If there's ever, when I am the commissar and people are getting re-education, that will definitely be a term that is banned.
It could be a new Donald Trump thing when keeping it real goes wrong. Like Donald Trump becomes president.
Keeping it real. I like that. So, you know, you had a piece that came out right after the election where you said that basically, along with several co-authors, I should add, the argument being that this is the time to sort of reaffirm a commitment to politics. Explain what you mean by that. And what kind of politics are you talking about?
That piece is interesting because that piece was written, I think we started it at 2:15 a.m., right after the election, or even before it was completely called, finished it by 2:45, 3 a.m., and it was a real fun piece to write despite the pressing circumstances of everyone being very distraught with the results. It was like an old school posse cut. I would write like two paragraphs, and then Catherine or Megan would write like two paragraphs or whatever. So it was a proper posse cut. But, you know, basically what we were trying to say is we could see what the response was going to be, and we could see the response would be this kind of vague attack on let's say, the notion of populism of all varieties, right? And obviously in America, populism has actually a deep and rich history. You know, it's a really slippery term. It's hard to say exactly what we mean when we say populism.
Right.
When we look back at, like, you know, a certain populist strand through the New Deal, through the Great Society, you know, before that, like every really progressive move in the U.S. has kind of had a lot of that spirit in it. And Trump obviously has this very nasty version of it. But in many ways, we wanted people to point out to people that this isn't, you know, some mandate for white supremacy. This doesn't mean that, you know, 40-something% of our friends and neighbors are irredeemable, you know, baskets of deplorables or whatever. This actually just tells us that, you know, this kind of centrist politics have failed. And a portion of the electorate, I should mention, this was the number three choice of people was to vote for Trump. The number one choice was to not vote. The number two choice was vote for Clinton. Number three choice
was
Trump, but enough.
And number one vote choice was actually Clinton because she did win the popular vote.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, we should note that, I mean, this election should have been a cakewalk. You know what I mean? Like,
definitely.
Donald Trump, like, I think 2 months before the election, he probably decided he didn't want to be president or something. Because even despite his usual, like, you know, verbal diarrhea, I think he got even more ridiculous and over the top. But so this should have been an easy one. You can imagine Marco Rubio was the nominee. You know, maybe Clinton would have even more trouble. But, you know, one thing that Trump captured was this kind of anger at you know, vaguely, it's vaguely defined, but establishment politics. And Clinton wasn't able to speak to that anger. And we wanted to really pin a lot of the loss on not Clinton herself personally, because in many ways, Clinton's become a scapegoat for all these kind of DNC centrist types.
Right.
Because they keep saying things like, oh, she's a bad campaigner, or whatever. No, what we saw last month was a repudiation of Clinton, but also Obama, also Biden, like the whole lot of those people. But, you know, and we said since the beginning, a lot of us who supported Bernie Sanders said, but you know what, like, we actually think he's the most electable candidate because he's actually speaking to anger. And you know, one way I could put it is this, you know, we, you know, the slogan that, of course, you know, propelled Trump was Make America Great Again. Clinton's response to it is so unbelievably out of touch.
Right.
And Obama's response, America's never stopped being great. I mean, and I think they captured the votes of a lot of people for whom that was true, or the very least, who could say that in the last 8 years, you know, their lives have gotten better, or at least haven't been devastated. So they could actually talk with a straight face about a recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of people who haven't seen a recovery, who haven't seen much from Democratic administrations, you know, you could see why they didn't support them. Or a lot of them stayed at home, and some of them voted for Trump. And if anything, if Trump's slogan was Make America Great Again, you know, the slogans that were coming from the Sanders Democrats and others, you know, the you know, good people in this race was, you know, Make America Great, you know, full stop, right? We might not concede that it's ever been that great, especially if you're on the wrong end of U.S. empire or whatnot. But, you know, that was kind of our message. And I think it worked well in the primaries among independents and self-described moderates, even partially because it was speaking to anger, and it was creating a narrative where, you know, we were acknowledging the conditions that a lot of people's lives are in. We were saying there is a better way, and we know who's responsible.
Right.
And I think that left populism is really going to be the salvation of U.S. politics, but we need to avoid falling into the kind of liberal trap and fall into this narrative that, hey, we don't have to listen. We don't have to talk to these people. We don't have to win over any of them. It's not even just about winning over a couple Trump voters here and there. It's about what kind of posture you're going to have towards politics and whether you're going to see it as like a technocratic thing where whenever the people get involved, things get messy because the people are dumb, or you're going to say that you actually want to create and expand democratic avenues. So that's what we meant when we said politics is the solution. We meant that democratic politics and engagement is how you win elections, and that's the opposite of the kind of technocratic approach by a lot of the centrists and the Democratic Party.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that in the macro sense, no question. But I think that there's a couple of things that we need to kind of disaggregate and tease apart. And then I think in other ways we can sort of leave some debates behind, which we need to have. But in a certain sense, if we were sort of doing smart, real progressive politics, they would become less important, or they would become more important, but in a more refined way. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. But I think there's no contradiction between saying that, look, there's no doubt that in the election of Donald Trump, and I would also say beyond Donald Trump, because I do think that the Republican Party has always represented white identity politics in the modern era to a not insignificant degree. And there's no doubt that if we just said sort of generically that, you know, the left populist response to the crisis of neoliberalism is rein in neoliberalism. The right-wing populist response is scapegoat and xenophobia. There is a lot of truth to that, and there's global dimensions to this as well. And I think we can see, obviously, that in the way the Trump administration is forming, is this going to be an administration that does anything about monopolies or banks? I find it highly unlikely. I think what we'll do is we'll have actually a kind of typical Republican horror show that you would get under Romney or Jeb, which is decimate the social safety net, hand more money off to rich people, deregulate. And you'll also have a voice that has been empowered of much more overt and less subtext racism. And that is a different sort of challenge. I do think that, you know, again, blaming Hillary as a campaigner is true. Although I think part of what we need to kind of balance with that is I do think that as bad as it is, I think Obama, if he was running for a third term, would have won. And I think Biden, if he was running, would have won. So part of it is kind of political skills. And I think that if we can kind of acknowledge the paradox of that, we can also, you know, see that a part of this does just have to sort of do with policy, with sort of retail political skills. But I think the third point that you're getting at that is also just really vital, that it's like in some ways kind of left populist politics of some variety is the only answer to all of these questions anyway, right? Like there's no contradiction. And in fact, it's serious left-wing populist politics is the only agenda that actually does fundamentally have something serious to say about dealing with structural racism, as an example, as something other than just saying that, you know, of course we condemn it, and we want to have like a cabinet that's diverse, which are important and laudable things, but they're not the same as saying we're going to tease apart the connections between market incentives and police brutality, as an example. So I think we can hold all three of those things at the same time and then hopefully start to kind of sculpt a politics that fits the moment and really represents that left populist wave, because the center is dead. And I also want you to comment on this. I don't think that the center ever really even existed. I think that there's the only people who have a sort of profile of kind of socially liberal-ish politics with neoliberal are a fraction of the population. And the only reason that they have an incredible amount of power and currency is because they have a lot of power and currency. They're completely overrepresented in all of the power fulcrums in American society. But there is no broad-based constituency of normal people, for better and for worse, who have that political profile. It doesn't exist.
I mean, I think one thing to point out about this actual strength of the center is the fact that we just don't have a social democratic party in this country. We don't have a labor party in this country. So as a result, you know, we're going to develop a politics that's going to be on one end of, you know, our center-left party is a party of social liberalism, which means you're going to offer kind of some degree of social protections, but primarily an economy built around increasingly deregulation and increasing corporate profits, and then hoping to maybe at best tax a little bit of that to redistribute around the margins. So in that respect, I think that, yes, there isn't a constituency beyond a small layer of academics and professional political types that actually believe in that politics as like a good mode of politics. But there is a large constituency of people who see that, in many ways, you know, even people like us might be in it, like as a better alternative than what the Republicans offer.
Yes,
if definitely. We're just kind of so I think yes, I definitely agree that consciously there's not a it wasn't a decision by the American people. It's more just we've been caught in this kind of politics by default. It's kind of an accident of history. You know, as far as the other points, you know, I largely agree. I mean, I think it's important to stress this continuity of in the Republican Party too, because we shouldn't forget that you know, Reagan's first campaign event was in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And, you know, Philadelphia, Mississippi is famous for absolutely nothing, absolutely, absolutely nothing, except for the murder of three civil rights workers,
right,
which happened a decade and change before Reagan went there to kick off his campaign. So it's not even...
And
like
talk about states'
that's
rights.
Like, that's an air horn.
And talk about states' rights. Story, you know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, not only... Yeah, I mean, literally talk about states' rights as well. I mean... It was, yeah, like you say, it was a foghorn. I mean, it might be even more blatant than Trump. Oh, we have it on screen up right now. There he is. And it's a very monochromatic background.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, so in many ways, I think the difference now is actually Trump is not offering the typical anti-black rhetoric that you got from the Republican Party throughout the 80s and 90s. Like, you know, so not only that, but Reagan's whole campaign, a lot of it was framed around this notion of, you know, pimps in their Cadillacs benefiting from welfare or welfare queens, you know, cashing government checks and having kids just to make a living off the government. Like all this kind of like thinly veiled, or not even veiled, racist attacks, which obviously Clinton picked up and ran with some of that too. But, you know, and in many ways, what I see from Trump and what I see from this new generation of Republican politicians is something a little bit far populist, right? Populist politician figures, something a little bit different. That's actually what worries me. So actually, just reading on the plane over, I'm in San Francisco now. So on the plane over, I was reading Adios America, which, by the way, is an awkward thing to read openly on a plane, this new Ann Coulter book.
But I have to say, Bhaskar, that is...
I'm a brown guy, so I get away with reading this on a plane.
That is literally just what I was going to say. There was no way that I could get away with that kind of research on a plane to San Francisco. Not going
to
happen.
Yeah, you would have to brown bag that.
Oh, yeah. definitely have to brown bag
that. Yeah. So I was like, this is the first time where I actually felt glad that I wasn't white at an airport. But so I don't know. What's actually really important in that book, though, or one among many, many points, is that she openly says there is only one group in the United States that has a claim on discrimination. They talk about oppression, discrimination, and that's black people, and that's a result of slavery, the horrible legacy of slavery. So she doesn't include Native Americans, but you know she mentions black people. She mentions that oppression. And I noticed throughout the Trump campaign that Trump, in many ways, was softer than your average Republican on even saying things like, even when he was condemning. He was saying some Blue Lives Matter stuff. He would also say, hey, by the way, and to the extent that people are getting shot unjustly, you know, that's messed up. We got to look into that.
Or he would say, that's not good. Not good.
Yeah.
Not
yes,
good.
Yes, it's bad.
Yeah. Bad.
And it makes, you know, so,
right.
So, you know, he had that. He had his, I know it was ham-fisted, but it's also kind of true when he's just like, Democratic politicians haven't delivered anything to you in a while. Like, I'm gonna build jobs and so on. And if you actually read Steve Bannon, who's the most terrifying of all those folks, not just because of his views, but because he's actually smart.
He's strategic,
Yeah, so he has this line that he talks about how, all right, he wants to build the Autobahn, you know what I mean? He's enough of a true fascist. That's kind of his model. So he wants to deficit spend. He wants to create huge jobs and infrastructure programs. He wants to build big things. And he thinks that like those kind of programs and that kind of real material impact in people's, you know, lives will mean that, you know, they won't win a majority of the black vote, but he thinks he could win 35-40% of it.
Right.
And even if you just uptick the percentage of the black vote that Trump got another, you know, 5-10%, you know, that's enough to cement to kind of right populist coalition. So that's the thing that's been keeping me up at night, the fact that Trump doesn't actually represent classic anti-black Republicanism, really, in the way Reagan did. He represents, I think, a new kind of xenophobic anti-immigrant populism that more resembles the European far right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously in the process of them trying to create, you know, what's essentially an ethno-nationalism out of American, you know, nationalism. But I do think that he could really, you know, if he had his shit together, he could deliver the goods, deliver something much more, you know, sweeping than any other Republican politician could offer, and actually could build a constituency. One good thing is, and this it was a huge relief when I saw how bad his infrastructure bill was.
That's awful.
And it is really just thinly veiled tax breaks and things like that. So I'm like, all right, this guy has been. You know, captured by Paul Ryan's influence and all these other people in the Republican Congress. Like maybe in fact Trump won't actually go through with some of his loftier plans, and maybe voices of people like Bannon will be drowned out by Paul Ryan types. Because, you know, if they really did pursue this aggressive project of government spending and trying to rebuild kind of a right populist coalition, you know, that would be the real danger. And the danger is, of course, that also Trump might not actually be a complete disaster of a president from a technocratic standpoint.
Right.
You know, he might, in fact, just be a run-of-the-mill administrator of the American state with some weird charm or charisma the way Rob Ford and Berlusconi had it.
Right.
So liberals that are afraid that everything, you know, he's going to push the red button and, you know, and blow up the world on day one, you know, I kind of have the opposite fear. My fear is that he would actually be decent enough to win a second term.
Yeah.
But hopefully, the way things are going, doesn't seem like, in fact, he is going to do that. But who knows? We've all underestimated him many, many times over the past couple of years.
Bhaskar Sunkara, smart guy. I think, though, that the there are two tracks here that are important to kind of define. Number one, I think you're totally right. Although I do want to, you know, underline, like, Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, I think there's no question that when it comes to functionality, the reality of structural racism, police killings, and even the inner city, you know, plans, the quote unquote real deal for urban mm-hmm. America that they've released is really like a major get rich quick scheme for real estate and basically a plan for like mass gentrification. So I agree with you that rhetorically it's different, but I do think there's a lot of old Republican racism in that sort of odd neo-fascist new bottle. But I think you're right that there is also a positioning of it very much because the much more overt stuff is with Muslim and Hispanic and this immigrant people. And you're right. Ann Coulter did sort of, you know, she kind of set that move in place with that Adios America book. But the paradox is that, right, if they go the Steve Bannon actual full neo-fascist route, that will be the one way in which it's like, oh my God, they might have actually done a few good things here. And again, as you say, I think that looks vanishingly unlikely. But that's the scenario where it's like, wait a second, we're entering something different here. Maybe they did do something about Amazon's monopoly. Maybe they did do some decent infrastructure and investment work. And it's a absolutely, you know, neo-fascist, overtly bigoted government. That's a sort of different challenge set that would be really, you know, sort of on just a new thing, a new danger, a new reality. I think what we're both saying, though, is that this is starting to just increasingly resemble, like, it's almost like Trump is the sort of eccentric wild card on top. And I think that we can't, no, I don't think he's going to press the button, but I do think he's going to create, you know, weird phone calls with Taiwan and Pakistan, which are going to create, you know, like unanticipated challenges. But underneath that, yeah, this is looking like the typical Republican agenda. Look at some, you know, put someone in charge of public education who wants to destroy public education. Put someone in charge of the EPA who doesn't accept climate science and is a bag person for every sort of, you know, environmental destroying interest you can imagine. I think that it's important to recognize that. And then I actually think it's important to loop back and get much more sort of overt here about, in fact, the sort of the incredible, again, actually traditional racism of something like the Ryan agenda. Because a full-scale assault on middle, working class, and poor people is very, very racialized. And I think that there might be a path there to sort of anchor the sort of left populism that we've talked about and clearly what we need inside a pretty robust conversation about what the real agenda is, at least functionally, of Republican politics.
Right. So what we've actually seen from Sanders and Ellison and others,
yeah,
we actually say kind of represents at least the politics that we need. Obviously, I'm to the left of Sanders, sure, and them, but, you know, I think that we're on a very short time horizon.
I think we need
a left populist administration in 2020, 2024. Yeah. Then hopefully there's a vibrant left current in and around it, you know. So, you know, what, to some degree, what the far right has now, but much bigger and brighter is kind of what I want, you know, as far as on the left. And the approach of Sanders and others, I think, makes a lot of sense to basically call Trump's bluff and basically just know that he's not really an anti-establishment figure. He's not going to really, you know, what do they say, drain the swamp. He's not going to really, he's appointing all out of these old Bush administration guys, and the few, you know, wild card choices that he's made for his cabinet have been just like white supremacists. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like this.
Picks that are untypical are Nazis. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, no, it really just, I think that Sanders, you know, his approach makes sense, and he'll be well positioned to be the choice for people to see that, you know, listen, there's kind of an old political class, both center left and center right, and, you know, they don't really like them. There's this new buffoon who's not really doing much, seems to be pandering to everyone. they're not going to like him. His favorability rates are, you know, it spiked a little bit. There's enough Americans to say, all right, he's president now, let's give him a chance. But his favorability rates are still in the 40s. Meehan Sanders' favorability rate's close to 60. I think that's a good sign of his position. He has a real national profile. Almost everyone in the country knows who Sanders is, and this wasn't the case even during the primaries, really.
Right.
You know, I think that's a you know, it's a good starting point for him. I think the problem is that our bench just isn't very deep. You know, I can't, you know, I know it's way ahead of the curve to be thinking about 2020 nominees, but I can't for the life of me. Maybe Sherrod Brown or something. I can't imagine who's going to represent the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, but I really think that has to be a time horizon. There needs to be a left populist, you know, push and presidency in 2020, or else we're screwed. Because I really think that the Democrats could mess this one up again. I think they could nominate Cory Booker. I think the lessons will fade so quickly that 2 years from now it'll be like a cycle, and we'll be back to where we were 2 years ago, and they'll be explaining away Clinton on her personal inadequacies and so on, and they'll be ready to nominate someone like Cory Booker.
Yeah, well, that's a total nightmare. I just want to say we're going to want to talk about Fred Hampton briefly, but the vision I had when you talked about the long-term plan is I'm president, I'm starting fights with people on Twitter, and you are my chief strategist with like the deep evil plans to really make America over.
It sounds good, man. You're better suited to be the wild card. I'll be behind the scenes. Don't worry.
I'm like, I don't know. Maybe I did want to talk to India. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I want to go to Carnival.
I think you'd win just alone on your Bill Clinton accent. You'd just go up and conduct an entire campaign for a year and a half with the Bill Clinton accent. I think that would work.
Hi, everybody. Let's talk about Fred Hampton. He was assassinated in 1969 on this date, December 5th of 1969. He was only 21 years old, which is... December 4th, excuse me. That was yesterday. 1969. He was only 21 years old and already an incredibly important leader of the Black Panthers. And nationally, he was which is just sort of extraordinary. In this clip, and it's very interesting to kind of go back and look at people from, you know, some people in the 60s did a very sophisticated political analysis. And in this clip, which you're going to play, and you'll hear Bhaskar, he's talking about how class politics intersects with race to sort of divide the working class and gives this very smart fusion of racial analysis and class analysis. Let's take a listen.
What makes them mad about it is that they have black people and white poor people and red poor people and Puerto Rican poor people and Latin American Puerto Rican people of poor people of all descent. They had them caught up in movements based on racism when the Black Panther Party stood up and said that we don't care what anybody says. We don't think you fight fire with fire best. We think you fight fire with water best. We're going to fight racism, not with racism, but we're going to fight with solidarity. We said we're not going to fight capitalism with black capitalism, but we're going to fight it with socialism. We stood up and said we're not going to fight reactionary pigs and reactionary state attorneys like this and reactionary state attorneys like Hanrahan with any other reactions on our part. We're going to fight their reactions with all of us people to get together and have an international proletarian revolution.
Right on.
And that's saying all power to the people.
Right on.
That's saying that no matter what color you are, there's only two classes. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason that this class over here has never did anything to get this class off its back, because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor. This is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people in this class have divided themselves. They say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbillies, I hate Indians. So we're fighting amongst each other. And you've heard the testimony of pigs here. You got pigs of all colors, you know that. You got pigs that are white, you got pigs that are black, you even got pigs that are black and white.
Okay, Bhaskar, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, it's shocking his level of, and just in general, the level of political sophistication of that generation of radicals. I mean, you have someone like Fred Hampton, who was so young, when he was emerging as a leader, he was 18, 19, 20, and he was murdered, like you said, when he was 21 years old. And he understood politics, and he understood how to win without compromising. You know, his politics were radical. You know, he was a Maoist. He was a black nationalist. You know, he didn't have compromised, you know, politics, but I think he represented really the best wing of the Black Panther Party, that the real socialist wing, the wing that really threatened capital. And there's a reason why Cleaver, you know, ended his life as a Reaganite Republican. And, you know, Fred Hampton ended his life at 21, you know, dead in his apartment, murdered by the FBI. But, you know, there's that clip where he, you know, just, I think, says what's more or less common sense, right? There's some nuance and complications we could add to it. But you know, fundamentally at its core, working people of all races would benefit from a broad multiracial kind of class movement. And that's one of the best ways to address racism. That's something Fred Hampton understood. And that's just what he expressed. Beyond that, if you listen to his clips when he's talking about some of the precursors to the Weather Underground and their actions in the days of rage and certain tactics of what he called ultra-leftist, petty bourgeois, anarchistic kind of just a style of street fighting. And he told them to go organize in their communities instead.
Right.
I mean, that kind of, again, you know, yeah, add some complications, add some, you know, nuance, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than he let on. But still, you know, that's a level of sophistication you wouldn't get today. And I think it tells you why it's important that we actually have political discussions and political education. We're reading, we're talking about theory, even if it seems disconnected from our day-to-day activism, because we just... I mean, I think in general, the left is less grounded in history. And in general, we're dumber than we were in the past. You know, a lot of us are kind of stuck in kind of a very vague and amorphous progressivism. And we were drawn to politics for the right reason. But Hampton, I think, really shows you, you know, what you could do with when you really think seriously about these issues and how it doesn't have to stop you from also being an incredible organizer and activist. It's not an either or. You know, we need more intellectuals that actually do political work, and we need more activists that you know, do intellectual work.
Yeah, no, it's really important, and I think what you're really basically saying there is Fred Hampton, great guy.
Great guy.
Great yeah. guy. Does a great... I mean, he did a great... 21, great job. It's true.
Yeah.
Bhaskar Sunkara, obviously many, many more conversations between us in many, many formats. In the future, I appreciate the work you do immensely, and I'll talk to you soon.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
All right, man.
Hopefully next time it'll be under better circumstances.
Well, I think if it's we wait for under better circumstances, we won't be talking for like another 10 years. So we'll be talking soon under similarly terrible circumstances.
All right, take it easy.
All right, you too. Bye-bye. Okay, everybody. We're going to get to the fun half. Fresh Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow. We talk about our cities and the commons movement, which we have this example from Barcelona, an example of how cities can be reinvented for the post-neoliberal age. We have an amazing brand F up, which is very fun. And we also have started taking your emails, the Two Dope Boys mailbag. So if you haven't already, subscribe to Two Dope Boys on a podcast on Stitcher or iTunes or twodopeboyspod.com. Spell it out fully on the website. It's the number 2 on iTunes. Yes, Kelly.
Can I have breaking news music, please? It's Matt's birthday.
You didn't tell me it was your birthday?
He's keeping it a secret like Sam, but it's his birthday.
You're such a creep. Happy birthday.
That'll make him a creep.
Happy birthday,
Stop.
Man.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm 28 years old today.
He's lying. He's like 22.
That's the first shofar I've ever gotten.
Yeah. Oh, that's weird. You deserve more than that. Well, happy birthday, young man. What are you planning on doing with your day?
I already celebrated over the weekend, so I'm going to take it easy tonight, I think.
Well, I hope you celebrated in fine form.
Yeah.
So apparently no type of gathering or get together.
I went out on Saturday night around Soho.
Oh, okay.
Stumbled around.
Yeah. Stumbled around Soho. I could see that. I think I did see like a.
I'm glad I didn't
gawky
know
super
because I would have gotten
Soho on Saturday.
I would have gotten anxiety that Mal would be
yeah,
so
Kelly
drunk.
Doesn't think I can get home.
No, I know that you can, but it just makes me a little bit worried.
I get worried about Matt getting home after we record Dope Boys. I get it. It's from North Dakota, for Christ's sake. You can join us in the fun half at 646-257-3920. The IMs are open, 646-257-3920. We got a lot to get to in the fun half. I don't know how to handle doing this Ben Carson impression anymore, and that he is literally in charge of American housing. That's just totally mortifying.
I just Googled the job I want. He wants me to do, and I thought it meant HUD, heads up display.
Heads up
display. Is that what that means?
Is that what
Hold on, I have to Google.
Hold on. It's called biblical real estate. These gentlemen want me to appear in a promotional video for it. What's the problem? All right, everybody, we'll see you in the fun half. Support our sponsors, Majority Report sponsors page. Become a member today if you can. There's no more important time to support independent media. Write the Majority Report a review. Write Two Dope Boys in a Podcast a review. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. All of those great things. We'll see you on the fun half.